I'm Renee Von Medding. Welcome to Disordered, a podcast about food, our relationship with our bodies, and learning to live and love yourself again. I am not an expert in eating disorders, but I am someone who has lived with one for almost two decades. I'm not here to give medical advice, but simply to try and unpick some of the complexity of disordered eating through a series of conversations I will have with people who are speaking from firsthand experience. Disordered eating will impact each and every one of us at some point in our lives. I want to delve deeper. At what point does disordered eating become an eating disorder? Through looking closer at the spectrum of these mental illnesses, I hope that you will be challenged in your own view of what an eating disorder looks like. So I guess I just wanted to put down on tape a little bit about my story and my background and why I'm here. So I suppose I developed an eating disorder at the age of 16. I'm now 33, so I've been living with this for almost two decades. But before the age of 16, I don't remember ever having a problem with food or weight or how I looked. I do remember looking at other people and thinking, oh wow, if I could just look like them, maybe I would get all the things I wanted in life. But I never actively tried to change the way I looked. It was never a thing for me. I was pretty fine up until 16, and then something changed. I was a theater kid, as I still am a theater kid, I guess. But we were doing a show in school, in secondary school, and there was a lot of dance involved. I think I also got sick around that time, and all of those things combined, and obviously stress and, just different exercise and eating habits, I just dropped a whole load of weight in a short space of time. It was around the time of my 16th birthday. It was like, September, October of that year, and it was just coming into transition year. And people started commenting and saying, wow, you look amazing. Have you lost weight? And that's why even now, that's something that just really bugs me when I hear people say, wow, you look great. Have you lost weight? I know for some people that might be like a real compliment, but for people like me, unbeknownst to you, that could be setting someone off into a spiral of disordered eating. Anyways, people said that to me for maybe, I don't know, the time period on it, maybe it was about a month. You look amazing. And then those comments kind of slowly started to shift to, are you okay? You don't look so good. You look tired. You look sick. But by that stage, it was too late. So I suppose when it all started and when people were saying, you look amazing, have you lost weight? Up until then, I wasn't consciously doing anything to lose weight. But once I started to get that sort of attention and praise and, people were really noticing me, then I started actively choosing my eating patterns and choosing what I would do day to day to make sure that I maintained that weight. So that kind of started as just restricting. And restricting means just basically not eating when you're hungry, or, withholding food and nutrition from yourself with the view to either maintaining or losing weight. When all this started, I just got really good at making people hear what they wanted to hear. And I hid it from so many people. So yeah, the restricting started, and it got worse and worse. And at some point, and I don't really remember the exact point, but I suppose it was a turning point for me when I realized that I could eat food and then make myself sick. But then by that stage, I was so scared of eating that I would restrict for long periods of time, and then I would get to the point where I couldn't not eat, and I would eat so much that I would feel physically like I was going to burst. And when people say, oh, I'm so full, I'm going to burst, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about that times 1,000. Like, I'm talking about like crazy amounts of food. And then I got to the point where I was hiding food and I was storing it up, and I just became obsessed with food. You know, so it was like kind of swinging back and forth between, I would not allow myself to eat for such a long period of time, and I would almost punish myself by doing that. And then I would know that I was saving up for a binge, and I would store all this food and I'd hide it. And it was all very secret. That's, you know, my eating disorder for me has always been very secret. And even now, it feels a bit strange to talk about it, because that was my thing and I didn't share that with anyone. And I didn't want anyone to know about it because it was mine, and it was the thing that made me feel like I had some sort of control, I suppose. And maybe that's something that I had been searching for a long time. And it kind of went on, and, you know, people obviously noticed. And for the most part, people would say, are you okay? And I'd be like, I'm fine. I'm totally fine. I'm so happy. And I was really good at pretending, and I still am really good at pretending. And for the most part, you know, people would kind of stop asking, because there's only so many times you can ask someone, are they okay, before you just have to stop. And I never got any help for it. It just kind of continued, and it went on for most of that year. And by the time I got to, I think it was maybe sixth year, things had kind of calmed down a bit. My weight had kind of leveled out. That's the thing also, when you're restricting, but then you're also binging and purging, you know, you can maintain a normal, huge inverted commas there, a normal BMI and a normal weight. And, you know, so weight doesn't necessarily at all determine whether someone is quite sick or not. For me, sometimes I was my sickest when I was at my most normal weight. So I suppose I'd leveled out and things kind of calmed down. And this has been the pattern throughout the last two decades, is when things are going pretty well in my life and with my relationships and my friendships and my family and with work or with my hobbies or my passions, when things are going well, it's easier to kind of step away from the disordered patterns. And when things are hard and when shit hits the fan, that's when you fall back on your eating disorder or your disordered patterns. So by the time I got to sixth year, I was pretty good, and you know, things were going pretty good, and I was pretty happy, and you know, I kind of thought that maybe it was just a phase that I had gone through and things would get better. And for a while they were better, and then they weren't, and then they were, and then they weren't. And it was this yo-yo back and forth for the next couple of years. By the time I got to 21, I figured I had a good hold of things. I wasn't, you know, binging and purging all the time. I wasn't restricting all the time, but I was doing a little bit, you know, so I was kind of back and forth. It was still very much a part of who I was. At 21, I met my wife and we started dating, and she knew right from the start. I told her very early on about kind of my history and how things were, and she kind of figured I was just okay most of the time, and we didn't talk about it too much. At this point, I still hadn't had any sort of therapy, any sort of kind of trying to figure out where this had all come from and what were the causes and why was I doing this and how could I get better. And this kind of continued. Again, I was better most of the time, but I wouldn't say I was not engaging in these behaviors. It was still very much a part of who I was. And again, it would always coincide with, you know, different things happening. If I didn't get a part I wanted, if I, you know, was disappointed with a friendship ending, anything, you know, that could be deemed as negative happening in my life would usually set me back a bit. Again, it just wasn't something that I really shared with anyone, not even Audrey. She knew a bit about it, but not a lot. We didn't talk very openly at that point about it. And then when I was 24, a fairly traumatic thing happened in the family, and one of my sister's babies was born very, very early. And we all thought she was going to die. This was her fourth baby. And she was based in the States. And it was at the end, I was just finishing up in college. We had our final showcase in college. And then I traveled to Seattle to live with them for 3 months and to take care of the three older girls while my sister was in hospital with the baby. And it was a really hard time. It was very much touch and go as to whether the baby would make it. And I was suddenly in charge of a 2, 4, and 6-year-old. And I was so happy to be there and to be able to help. But I suppose I absorbed a lot of that pain and that kind of that fear, and I absorbed a lot of that without even knowing, and I did not even realize what was happening. But I very, very, very quickly fell back into my eating disorder, and by the time Audrey came over to visit, halfway through the 3 months, she came over, I think 6 weeks into my stay there, she came over to visit, and I'll always remember her face when she saw me, when she arrived, when I picked her up at the airport. It was like she didn't recognize me, and I didn't even notice what had happened. I know that sounds a bit silly saying, you know, you cannot notice, but it's true. When you're in it, when you're living it every day, you can go very quickly from a good to a not so good place and just not even realize. So when she arrived, again, we didn't really talk about it too much, but I knew that she knew, and it was not great. She went home. I stayed for another month and a half. I got worse. I got increasingly preoccupied with my eating disorder, and it was very much controlling me as a person. I then came home and continued working and just got worse and worse. And at that point, I think, you know, very close family members and friends started asking me to get help. And up until that point, so I would have been almost 25 at that stage, I still had never, ever in my life said the words aloud, "I have an eating disorder." I had never said it, not even to myself, not even in my head. I never said those words because I didn't want to admit it, and I didn't want to give it. I didn't want to release the control of it, I suppose, because I knew once I said it, I would have to acknowledge it and I would have to do something about it. I would have to make a choice either to do or not do something about it. And I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to kind of keep going the way I was going. But it just got to a point when I knew I had to make a choice. And I think my decision of, asking for help and going and making that first step was very much related to seeing the pain I was causing Audrey. You know, I could see in her eyes that she thought I was going to die. And she said that to me. She said, "You are going to die if you keep doing this." And I think she's right. I think I would have if I didn't choose to go get help. And I wasn't living a happy life. It wasn't happy. You know, there were moments of happiness. It wasn't all bad. But that kind of existence of just thinking about food all the time, just obsessing about it all the time, you are not able to get away from it. Like, Christmas was the worst time of the year for me. It was terrifying. I didn't want to be around people. I didn't want to be forced to eat around people. I didn't want people to look at me while I was eating. I didn't want to be around anyone else when I was eating. Because for me, I just wanted to restrict and then I wanted to binge in private. And that was such a private thing. And I did not want to do that around anyone else. And I never did do that around anyone else. So, you know, celebrations like Christmas or birthdays or any sort of parties were just such a miserable occasion for me. And that's no way to live. So when I was 25, I went to my GP and I said, "I need help. I have an eating disorder," and kind of went from there. Best thing I ever did, hardest thing I ever did. Just admitting that for the first time, it's really hard to do that. And it's a really brave step to do. But I promise the first time you say it is the hardest, and it gets easier after that. Then, you know, I started telling more people over the course of the next few months, the next few years. My GP got me into emergency therapy. I suppose my weight was not low enough to talk about inpatient treatment. I know things have changed quite a bit in the last decade or two even, when it comes to treating eating disorders in Ireland, but at the time I didn't feel like there was a lot of help for me, a lot of options, and it was really just going through the GP. And I'm very grateful that my GP got me into a program, and once I was in the system, I saw a couple of different therapists until I landed with one who was just amazing. And if he is listening to this, you know who you are, and you helped me to save my own life, because without that, I never would have understood why I do the things I do and why I think the way I think. And that's definitely something I've learned over the last while, is that you cannot ever get any way better, or you can never recover in any way unless you talk. You have to communicate. You have to talk. You have to say these things out loud to another person, to yourself. And to try and understand why we do the things we do. So I spent a couple of years in therapy and very much kind of understood, you know, why I was doing the things I was doing. And I suppose I was pretty much a classic case of someone who's at risk of developing an eating disorder. You know, I was a perfectionist. I still am. I liked to control things. I liked to be in charge of things. I liked to know what was happening. I liked to be, you know, in charge. I liked to be the leader. I still do. Oh my God. I suppose all these things are not necessarily bad things. It's just learning how to utilize these character traits for good. And, you know, other things that can play a role too, like traumas in your life. And when I say trauma, it doesn't have to be, you know, the death of someone, though for me it was, you know, my dad died when I was 2, and then my mom remarried at the age of 13, which in itself is kind of like another trauma, you know, losing your other parent to a new marriage, if you know what I mean. It's, you know, obviously she didn't die, but it is a loss in a way. You know, and some people have feel these traumas in other ways. It can be, you know, the breakdown of a relationship. It can be the loss of a job. It can be the death of a pet. It can be moving house or moving school. You know, they don't have to necessarily be these massive, big, traumatic things. If they feel traumatic to an individual, that's what matters. And, you know, obviously people can be genetically predisposed to developing these things also. There's not a huge amount of research into it, but there is some, and it does seem like you can be genetically more likely to develop one than another person. So was it just a series of events and, you know, you turn one way and one thing happens, you turn another and another happens? What is that, like sliding doors? Anyway, one of the really big drives for me to get better was we knew we wanted kids. And when I was at my lowest point, I always remember saying to myself, there is no way I would ever bring a kid into this. I would never, ever allow my child to see me like this and to think that that's okay and to think that your worth as a person is defined by a number on a scale or what you look like in the mirror or how good you are at controlling what goes into your body. That is not what defines a person's worth. And even though I knew that, I couldn't quite tell, like I couldn't quite apply it to myself. Like I've always been really good at telling other people that they're amazing and they don't need to change a thing. And yet it's next to impossible to apply that logic to myself and to be kind to myself. Another big turning point for me was when one of my nieces, we have like a million nieces and nephews, but one of my nieces was two. And in my mind, she will always be two, probably because this was such a big turning point for me. I remember babysitting her, and it was at a time when I was just at the lowest of the low. And I remember babysitting her overnight, and then I think I had to ask my mom to come and take her for a while because I literally just did not have the energy to be with her. And I remember being in their house and just so broken and so empty and so sad. I'm not even sad, because I was too tired to be sad. I was just done. I was just done with everything, and I knew that I had to either choose to live or I just wanted it to be over. And I was never suicidal, but I was at the point where I just wanted it to stop. And the way I saw it was I had to choose to get better or I had to die. And I didn't know how to make that happen, because I didn't want to die, but I didn't know how to live. So I guess a really ironic thing that happened was when I started getting better, I got better for a time, and then I kind of started feeling pretty crap again, and I didn't know what was going on, because I actually was treating my body well for the first time in over a decade, and I started feeling just really tired again all the time, and just lots of little things happening. And I suppose at that stage I didn't really recognize my body anyways, so all these new symptoms that were appearing, I just assumed it was kind of all a part of the recovery. And so I was gaining weight and I was doing well, but then I started losing weight again and I couldn't understand it. And I suppose the doctors kind of dismissed it because of my history, and they just thought I was lying to them and that I was back in my eating disorder. And the only person really who believed me was Audrey, because she lived with me and she knew what my habits were, and she knew me inside out, so she knew that I was not lying to her anymore. And I had a pretty crazy diagnosis / near-death experience when we traveled to Australia for the first time. And I went into a coma. Audrey got me into an emergency room. She thought I was dead. And I was diagnosed as a type 1 diabetic. So that was a massive life change again for me. So I had close to a week in the ICU, and then the rest of our holiday was spent with me kind of recuperating, trying to get to grips with this new condition that I had, illness that I had, and, you know, trying to get my head around the fact that I would now have to inject insulin for the rest of my life if I wanted to live. So I suppose a pretty bizarre and ironic twist of fate there, that when I was getting better from an eating disorder that, you know, was totally about food and exercise and controlling everything, that it kind of shifted into a different type of thing that was also about food and controlling everything and knowing every, you know, decision that I make in the day regarding food and exercise. Going through pregnancies were hard. My first pregnancy, I remember I gained so much weight, and there's no right amount of weight to gain or not to gain in pregnancy, but, you know, doctors have charts and numbers and what you should and shouldn't gain, and they weigh you constantly. So all of it was obviously quite triggering for me. But yeah, being pregnant and going through different stages of your life can be hard for people who have had either an eating disorder or disordered eating. Something that I talk about a lot is the word recovery and what recovery means to you. So to me, I feel like I am in recovery, and I don't quite believe that I will ever be fully recovered. I don't understand at this point in time how I could get to a place in my life where I never had thoughts of restricting or binging or purging, or where I never had thoughts about how my worth was dependent on the weight I am today or how I look today. And while I've gotten really good at pushing aside those thoughts as soon as they come into my head, I know how easy it is to allow those thoughts to take hold again, even if only for an hour or a day or a week. Because there have been many times in the last couple of years where I've allowed those thoughts to take hold, even just for a short amount of time. And I wouldn't say I've gone back to an active illness, but it's still there. And I like to think that I could get to a place where it's not there anymore, but I just don't know. And I want to have hope, and I want other people to have hope. And I suppose for people who are in a really, really, really dark place, the place that I was in at the age of 25, where I just had to make a choice between living or dying, it is possible to get to a really good place. And it is possible to have a family and to have a life and to do good. It is possible. One of my biggest fears is that either of my daughters would ever, even for a second, feel the way that I have felt for most of my life, and to ever question themselves about what they're eating. If they want to eat something, don't feel bad about it. Don't regret it. Don't punish yourself. Don't obsess about it. I just want them to have a healthy relationship with food and a healthy relationship with themselves, and just know that they are completely and utterly perfect, and that their weight, the way they look, does not determine who they are as people. So if I could do anything with my life, it would be to make sure that they do not ever, ever for a second feel the way that I have felt for most of my life. If I could stop that from happening to them, if I could stop that from happening to any other child, any other teenager, any other adult, well then, that's all I could ask for, really. In a weird turn of events, my mom was going through her attic and came across a ton of stuff that I had saved over the years. I am a writer, among other things, and I've always been a writer. I suppose my writing when I was a teenager was quite angsty. But I came across a pile of writing from when I was 16, right after my eating disorder had developed. And I have in front of me one of the poems that I wrote. And I actually got it published. Our secondary school had like a literature kind of magazine type thing. And you could get your prose or your poetry published. And I actually had a poem about my eating disorder published in my school magazine. Now, it's not, if you didn't know it was about my eating disorder, you wouldn't really know what it was about. You would just think it's, you know, angsty 16-year-olds writing. But anyways, I'm going to read it for you now. And it's called Saying Something. I do not do this because I want to, but because I must. Sitting, standing, resting, nothing. Driven by a thing I do not know. Tossing and thrown, caught between myself and time. Carried along in the full swell and fall. Participation is the key to immortality. And so they hate me. Not I feel from badness. Sometimes feeling anything is more bearable. Eyes do not see and bodies are immune to sensation. Apathy masqueraded as reality while hunger rages beneath. Look at you, trying to survive. Why all the hurt? Why must I say something? So through this whole podcast, something that I really want to kind of explore is, at what point does disordered eating become an eating disorder? And that's a tricky question because it's not black and white. It is a very big spectrum. I suppose the point at which it becomes a really big problem is when it's something that you cannot live without, when you cannot get through a day without doing something. It becomes a compulsion. So if you cannot get through the day without restricting your food, without being in control of what you are eating in a very, very strict sense, if you cannot get through the day without having planned a binge and a purge, if you cannot get through the day without all of these disordered thoughts and behaviors, maybe that's the point at which it becomes an eating disorder. And that's really what I want to share with people, is that you may think that an eating disorder is something that has never touched you in your life and it's never affected you or anyone that you love. But it could. And that's what I want people to know. It could. And everyone is at risk. No one is immune. It affects all people from all walks of life, all genders, all sexual orientations, all races, all religions. No one is immune. And if we could just open up this conversation, if this could be something that we talk about more, maybe it wouldn't be as hard for those suffering going forwards, and maybe less people would suffer because it's something that we are aware of and that we are conscious of and that we are careful for. And conscious of these things, that we do not allow them to take hold, and that we can recognize when disordered behavior is starting to take over. If you need medical advice, please speak to a professional or contact Bodywise, the national charity for eating disorders in Ireland, on 01 210 7906. Thank you again for listening, and I hope that this conversation has been helpful to you in some way. I'm Renee Von Medin, and this has been Disordered.